I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, what issues are resonating in three states with tight Senate races heading toward November's general election? But first, new concerns about the relationship between the U.S. and one of its chief allies in the war against terrorism, Pakistan. President Pervez Musharraf has told the CBS program 60 Minutes that the U.S. threatened to bomb Pakistan back to the Stone Age if he didn't switch his support from Afghanistan's Taliban regime to the American-led war on terrorism after the 9/11 attack. Musharraf said the threat came from Richard Armitage, then Deputy Secretary of State. Armitage denies that in an interview with CNN. And to make matters more interesting, President Musharraf is in the U.S. In fact, he held a news conference this morning with President Bush, in which President Bush said he was unaware of any threat, he was taken aback by what he heard, and it didn't make any sense.
Matter of fact, my recollection was that one of the first leaders to step up and say that the stakes have changed, that attack on America that killed 3,000 of the citizens needs to be dealt with firmly, was the president.
Holly Bailey is White House correspondent for Time magazine. She joins us now. And Holly, this has been a very, it seemed like an odd moment. And further, President Musharraf was asked about, you know, this alleged threat, and he said he couldn't respond because of his book deal.
Right, and that was probably, I think, one of the most unusual responses I've ever seen in a White House news conference before. I can't think of anything else. And, you know, obviously, you know, you heard in the background a lot of people laugh, and I think even the president was a little surprised. And, you know, I think it's, I hope that the White House doesn't kind of learn that line to ease on us later.
Well, it just seemed, I mean, this is very serious, important foreign relations, and they're now being governed, apparently, by Simon and Schuster. but both men emphasize that still they have trust and confidence in each other, even if apparently they can't talk about something because of a book deal. But this comes as, you know, there have been questions about Pakistan's allegiance. Did those questions come up, you know, Pakistan recently signing a peace deal with tribes in an area where Al-Qaeda is said to be, or Pakistan being thought to back the insurgent Taliban?
Yeah, the president was asked, President Musharraf was asked directly about that, and he defended that, saying that it was not in agreement with the Taliban, that it was the tribal leaders not to, you know, basically pledge allegiance to the Taliban. But what I find interesting is that, you know, this is the, you know, I think this is the second time in the last year that the president has met with President Musharraf. We were in Pakistan almost a year ago. It was earlier this spring, and at that time, you know, they sort of, you know, lean over backwards to mention, you know, what a great relationship they have, how much they trust each other. But clearly all signs are, at least on both sides, that both sides have, you know, some issues here with trust.
Is there any real concern on the part of the White House, though, that President Musharraf might be removed or even assassinated? The president spoke of him being targeted, you know, because of his stance, speaking in defense of President Musharraf. And I'm imagining that even with their concern with President Musharraf's allegiance, they may think he's better than an alternative.
Absolutely. And I think that's why you're not seeing the White House strike back more forcefully on, you know, President Musharraf making these comments. You know, they are realized that he is in a tenuous political situation. Obviously, I think a lot of people in Pakistan probably do not appreciate the relationship that Musharraf has with President Bush. President Bush is not popular there, and I think a lot of people are more sympathetic to the Taliban or, you know, perhaps, you know, people who are close to bin Laden than they are to, you know, appreciating the relationship between Pakistan and the United States. So I think that's why you saw, I mean, the president said that he was surprised to hear that comment, but, you know, obviously, they haven't pushed back on any of these, you know, sort of questionable deals that Musharraf has had with people in the region.
Well, next week, President Bush meets with President Musharraf and the president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai. We mentioned the suspicion on the part, we've heard from several reporters in the last couple of weeks, that Pakistan is backing the Taliban resurgent insurgency in Afghanistan, in part to stave off India's influence in the area. So just in the few seconds we have, is there a feeling there might be a turning point in what seem to be frayed relations?
Well, I think, you know, what the most important thing is to come out of this meeting next week is whether they can all sort of get on the same page and get along. I think, you know, repairing relations between all three in a region that is becoming, you know, more difficult for the United States every day is very important.
Holly Bailey, White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. I apologize. I think I moved you over to Time magazine there for a second. She's with Newsweek and with us for these last few minutes. We thank you very much, Holly.
Thank you.
Details are still emerging on the White House and Senate compromise on the interrogation and trials of terrorism suspects. Both sides appeared to have made some concessions, although President Bush may have made bigger ones than the senators that were first objecting to his plan. It's not clear what final form this deal will take once it comes up for votes in Congress, and the political fallout from the deal also remains to be seen. Recent polls have shown a slight uptick for the president, as well as a great deal of voter uncertainty over the war and significant dissatisfaction with politicians. Well, today we want to spend some time hearing about how voters are behaving in some of the most watched Senate races in this country. We're joined on the line by three journalists from states where some of these most watched election races are taking place. Jim Strang is editorial writer for the Cleveland Plain Dealer in Ohio. Welcome, Jim.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Mike Dennison is political reporter for five daily newspapers in Montana. He joins us from Helena. Mike, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And we also welcome Sandy Shea, editorial page editor for the Philadelphia Daily News in Philly. Sandy, hi.
Hi.
And just to throw this out to all of you first, without getting into these details, which are, you know, sketchy, is this debate over detainees and torture, is this resonating with your readers? Do they want to hear more about it?
Well, we have just conducted a recent poll that shows that actually the war on terror is becoming more of a concern on voters' minds. However, I do think that how this gets actually played out in the coming elections in terms of this this vote on detainees is going to be an interesting thing to watch.
And that was Sandy in Philadelphia. Jim in Ohio, I mean, are people talking about this?
We get some concern about it. Our letter writers weigh in on it periodically, but there's no overwhelming movement about the torture into this thing. The split out here seems to run like the national split does. Everybody's worried about security. Everybody's uncomfortable or flatly against the war in Iraq. And that's a dichotomy that voters are struggling to settle before November.
Mike, how about you in Montana?
Well, I think it's too early to tell in Montana, but you can't deny that the war is a big issue in the race here between our Republican incumbent, Comrade Burns, and the Democratic challenger, John Tester. Tester has said from the beginning that he thinks the war is a mistake, and he's called for a plan for withdrawal, and Burns has been reading right from the Republican script and is hammering away on Tester, saying he's cut and run and softened terrorism. I don't know how this is going to play out, but it's a very clean split between the candidates in discussing this.
Well, let's talk more about this race. Each of you has a race which could help tilt the control of the Senate. As we know, Democrats need just six seats to gain the Senate. They need 15 in the House, and that's seemed possibly more likely. But these Senate races are tight. Mike, you mentioned the very colorful Republican incumbent, Conrad Burns. He's been linked with the congressional lobbying scandal with Jack Abramoff. And yet he's still in this tight race with also colorful organic farmer John Tester. You know, Burns, we hear, has been jeered at debates because of his ties to Abramoff. And those would seem, you know, to undo any other candidate. Why is it as tight as it is?
Well, Burns has always had tight races. He's kind of, like you said, he's a colorful guy, and I think he kind of antagonizes some people sometimes. But this time, the Abramoff thing has been a role early. Democrats are hammering away on him. And Tester is a very likable guy, and I think the conventional wisdom is that Tester has a lead and that he's trying to kind of sit on it almost, and Burns has been attacking from the get-go. Every time you see an ad or a flyer or anything, you hear liberal, liberal, liberal. They're just trying to define him before he can define himself. And Tester really hasn't fired back that hard, and I think a lot of Democrats in the state are kind of scratching their heads and wondering, when's he going to start punching back?
Well, I have to say, punching, you know, it does get pretty punchy there in Montana. Your fellow Conrad Burns, again, the incumbent, has used some pretty colorful language. I'm not even sure we can say it. He got into a verbal brawl with some firefighters. He wasn't happy with the way they were fighting some fires. And he used some language that I guess his opponent can't even use in campaign ads on television.
The Broadcasters Association of Montana has told the TV stations they probably shouldn't run it because they might be violating FCC regulations.
Yeah, so it gets awfully colorful there in Montana. But you mentioned that L word. And, Sandy, I want to turn to you there in heavily Democratic urban Philadelphia, arguably the most watched Senate campaign, close Bush ally incumbent Rick Santorum, slightly trailing in the polls behind Democrat and State Treasurer Bob Casey. Does the L word get thrown around there?
No, it doesn't as much here. What's happening, though, what's interesting to watch is pretty much like Ohio's race, everyone's kind of stepping back and waiting for the Democrat to really come out and start fighting back. Right now, he's, I think part of his lead is based on some anti-Santorum feeling rather than any particular strength on his own part.
Well, now remind us, anti-Santorum feeling, his opponent, Bob Casey Jr., is saying that he votes with George Bush 98% of the time. He was considered, you know, the uber-conservative.
Yes.
Is that what you mean by anti-Santorum?
Yes, and in fact, you know, right now, at least in southeastern Pennsylvania, Bush is considered to be a liability for Santorum.
You know, what's really interesting about that race there in Pennsylvania is the candidate the Democrats chose to go up against Rick Santorum. Tell us a little bit more about this Democratic challenger, Bob Casey, in that he represents a more moderate wing of the party. He is opposed to abortion. He doesn't endorse a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq. I mean, unlike, for instance, the Connecticut race we just saw with moderate Joe Lieberman upset by, a progressive Democrat in the primary there, it seems what's needed in Pennsylvania is a more moderate to take on the conservative Santorum.
That's true. That's true. Again, though, I think people are surprised that he's not showing more of a clear image or a strong fighting spirit in this campaign. It's really hard to call.
Well, Jim, check out your state now, Ohio. Republican incumbent Senator Mike DeWine about even in the polls with Democrat and current Congressman Sherrod Brown. DeWine, of course, a supporter of the president's policies in Iraq. How's that affecting him, and why are they calling his opponent far out Brown?
Well, Sherrod is, by the National Journal's polling ratings, one of the most liberal members of Congress in the Ohio delegation. He's second only to Dennis Kucinich in his liberal voting record. But Ohio is a maelstrom this year. There's so many things going on here. There's been a statewide Republican scandal. The governor pleaded guilty earlier this year to four misdemeanors of accepting contributions without reporting them, for taking free golf games. There is what we call CoinGate. It's a major scandal with a Republican rainmaker in Toledo, a guy named Tom Noe, who is facing several years in federal prison for various campaign funding violations. So DeWine, who has had very little, if anything, to do with any of that, finds himself carrying some of that burden, too. Now, the Democrats say that DeWine's voted with the president only 92% of the time, so he's got a little bit better than Pennsylvania does. But he's been trying to cast himself as a moderate. But even at that, this one's tighter than a tick on a whitetail.
And that's pretty tight. That's Jim Strang, editorial writer for the Cleveland Plain Dealer in Ohio. We're also joined by Mike Dennison, political reporter for five daily newspapers in Montana, and Sandy Shea, editorial page editor for the Philadelphia Daily News. They'll all be back with more of our Friday editorial roundup that's coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're checking in on three hotly contested Senate campaigns with three journalists who've been closely watching these races. Mike Dennison, political reporter for five daily newspapers in Montana, Sandy Shea, editorial page editor for the Philadelphia Daily News, and Jim Strang, editorial writer for the Cleveland Plain Dealer in Ohio. And Jim, I want to start with you. I want to ask you about a recent poll we read about in your state. It's from the Quinnipiac University Polling Institute. It found that 55% of likely voters disapprove of the way President Bush is handling the war in Iraq. 50% said going to war in the first place was the wrong thing to do. But few voters in the poll said that the war had any influence on how they were going to vote.
Right. There's a disconnect here with this war. You know, with the volunteer army, it doesn't strike across the spectrum of the body politic the way the conscripted army did in Vietnam, which was the war of my generation. And the casualty rates, frankly, are not that high. We've had AP counts 127 Ohioans killed either in Iraq or Afghanistan since both those conflicts started. And, yeah, we have stories of kids coming home in caskets, but it hasn't sunk in yet. There's a general distaste for this war, but there's also a very deep concern about questions of national security. We don't have a lot of big cities, but we do have Cleveland on Lake Erie, which 20 miles out is Canada, And so we are, and we are not often thought of, but we're a border state in that regard. Mm. So national security concerns play against war concerns, and we don't see either of those surfacing yet as the main issue.
Mm, that's in Ohio. But Sandy Shea, back to you in Philadelphia with the Philadelphia Daily News. What's top of mind of voters in Pennsylvania? What are the issues that they care about?
Well, I can speak to one very big, actually two very big issues that are being played out in Philadelphia, which also have statewide implications. One is gun violence, and the second is gambling. And gambling is interesting because it is something that was imposed by the legislature about 18 months ago. It is mandating casinos and racetracks to be implemented in cities and counties across the state.
Hmm. Requiring cities and cities to put them in?
Absolutely. Philadelphia, for example, is getting two casinos. And so we are top of mind dealing with a lot of the implications of that. Still reeling, in fact, from the implications of the state legislature passing a gambling act basically with no public hearings and passing it in the middle of the night. And, you know, obviously this is going to have a huge impact on the city. But adding insult to injury here in Philadelphia, the legislature in Harrisburg is now attempting to pass a law that would preempt the city's ability to impose its own zoning laws on these casinos. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing a lot of activity from neighborhood groups, community groups, lots of unrest in the neighborhoods where these casinos may be, not just for their very presence, but for the contemptible way the state legislature is imposing its will on the cities, and particularly on this city.
Well, Mike, in Montana, you've got a topic somewhat like that. We just want to check in on that. I guess in November, Montanans are going to be asked to weigh in on rules for seizing homeowners' property to make way for development. This came out of a recent Supreme Court ruling. Is that powerful there?
Well, yes and no. At this point, that initiative and a couple others have been thrown off the ballot because of fraud. Because of fraud in the signature gathering process, it's been appealed to the Supreme Court. And as you probably know, that property rights initiative is one of many across the country that's being promoted by groups that want to limit the power of government. But it's off the ballot right now in Montana, and we're waiting to see what the court does. You know, one thing that I wanted to talk about was something that Sandy mentioned in the Senate race in Pennsylvania about Casey really not defining himself.
This is the Democratic challenger.
Yes, the Democratic challenger. And the same thing is going on here with Tester not really defining himself either, and it kind of makes me wonder what's going on with the Democratic strategy here. Because I talked to a Democratic strategist here in Montana the other day, and he was kind of wondering to himself, saying, why aren't these guys hammering away on issues like health care, education, Social Security, which they should know that they probably can win against Republicans, but they're really not doing it.
You're talking about the organic farmer John Tester, who's challenging the incumbent Republican Conrad Burns. And I guess that is a question nationwide. Will the Democrats be able to come up with that definition by November? But Jim, in Ohio, just want to just get one, you know, check in on what's going on right now. Just tell me, what's the top local story in your paper, above the fold?
Okay, our top story today is Walmart coming out with a plan to sell a lot of generic drugs for a maximum of $4, which is a big story here because we have an aging population. We have a lot of young folks leaving the state. That's part of our economic problems. But Sherrod Brown, again, who's running for Senate against Mike DeWine, has been organizing bus trips up to Canada for seniors to go up and buy prescriptions and come back. So a breakthrough like that will be received well in Ohio, but it doesn't speak to the larger question of Medicare and health problems among our older people.
And it just is another reminder, I guess, as we wrap this up, you guys, that it does seem, at least for now, at least taking the temperature in these three places, in these three races, that it's still local issues that resonate most with voters. That's Jim Strang, editorial writer for the Cleveland Plain Dealer in Ohio. Mike Dennison has been talking to us as well, political reporter for five daily papers in Montana. He was speaking to us from Helena. And Sandy Shea, editorial page editor for the Philadelphia Daily News in Philly. Thank you all so much for talking to us today.
My pleasure, Robin. My pleasure as well.
And Jim, there in the newsroom in Ohio, give that guy next to you a cough drop.
All right. right, we'll do it.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And this quick note before we take a break. Imagine that. We just heard a plan to sell generic drugs for $4. Now, your coffee is going to cost even more than that. Starbucks is planning to raise prices. Starting October 3rd, you'll pay an extra 5 cents for a Starbucks latte, cappuccino, or drip coffee. That's a 1.9% increase and the company's first increase in 2 years. And their coffee beans will go up by about 50 cents per pound, a nearly 4% increase. The first price increase for whole beans in 9 years. Starbucks prices vary on the market, but right now here in Boston, a venti vanilla latte with an extra shot of soy milk costs $4.89. Tax included. Lynn, what will you do? Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. With U.S. forces stretched thin in Iraq and Afghanistan, you might think military recruiters would welcome just about anyone who showed up at their offices. That's what this young man thought.
Four of us genuinely want to serve. We just shouldn't have to lie about ourselves in order to do it.
That's 20-year-old Matt Comer, a native of North Carolina, who went to the Army recruiting station in Greensboro yesterday with three other people to try to enlist. And he was turned away.
The recruiter has said that the media cannot come in.
There's no video cameras or cameras in 11 years, sir.
No. We're going to respect their wishes. This is their office.
The hubbub is because Comer is part of a small but nationwide movement called the Right to Serve campaign, which is challenging the government's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, which bars openly gay people from serving in the military, by sending openly gay people to recruiting stations to try to enlist. Jake Rayton is one of the organizers of the Right to Serve campaign. He joins us in the studio. And Jake, the Urban Institute estimated in 2004 that there are already 60,000 homosexuals quietly serving in the military. Now, some Americans would say, there you go. That shows you have the right to serve. You just don't have the right to talk about being gay while you serve. But they say you have the right to enlist. What's wrong with that, with Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
Well, a lot's wrong with Don't Ask, Don't Tell. First, even if you don't tell, someone can report that you're gay, someone can report that you're in a same-sex relationship or that you attempted to get married to someone of the same sex. And so every day, people who are gay and live under this policy live in fear of being kicked out. Moreover, I think straight people just don't understand what it's like to be in the closet. It's not as simple as just, you know, not saying that you're gay. Everyday questions about seemingly innocuous things. What did you do last night? Who'd you have dinner with? Who you on the phone with? Mm-hmm. You have to lie and hide and cover up in order to remain closeted.
Well, so your organization is sending openly gay people to recruiting stations to try to enlist as gay people. But the law is clear. Openly gay people are not eligible to serve. So what's the goal of the action?
The goal is to honestly find out what happens when an openly gay person tries to enlist, to see how the government will receive their desire to serve.
But the question isn't asked. So are you telling people to go in and say it? You know?
Yes, because we think it's an unjust burden to put on someone to say that you can't openly identify as being gay.
Right. And you know that when they do, they're going to trigger a chain reaction that the recruiter has no control over, right? That they're going to have to say you can't enlist.
No, we don't blame individual recruiters for this policy. We blame the U.S. Congress and, you know, President Clinton in particular, the president who signed the law. So what we're trying to do is bring attention to the fact that this discrimination exists and to highlight legislation that would help repeal it. It's called the Military Readiness Enhancement Act. It's currently before the House. There's about 112 co-sponsors. We need about twice as many to get it passed through the House, and then we need a Senate version of the bill yet. And so there's a long road to go.
It seems that the military's caught on to you, though, because initially we saw some photographs, for instance, after people had gone into recruitment stations, said they were gay. Then there was an action outside, a protest, media would come. But now, well, tell us what happened. You went to New York. They knew you were coming, and what happened?
Well, we had three young folks who went with us to enlist in New York City in Times Square, probably one of the most famous recruitment centers in the country. And when we got there, they chose to lock it up. We're not going to take that no as an answer. Those three young folks are going to return at a later date and try to enlist again. We need to show to the American people that this discrimination is real and that it's happening at a time when we can't afford it to happen. We're not reaching the recruitment goals that we want to reach. We're lowering our recruitment standards in terms of the IQ level of enlistees, in terms of the physical fitness of enlistees, in fact, in terms of the psychological preparedness of the enlistees. So there's a lot of problems with enlistment today, recruitment rather, today.
But as you know, groups such as the Center for Military Readiness mm-hmm. have said that, in fact, the recruitment of openly gay people would have the opposite effect. It would deter heterosexuals who'd want to sign up from signing up.
Certainly that hasn't happened in other countries where the ban has been lifted. Of the NATO nations, there's only two that still don't allow openly gay people to serve their country, and that's us and Turkey. Countries like Israel and Britain and Germany that have very similar U.S. military structures to ours allow for openly gay service.
By the way, how old are you?
I'm 24.
Would you want to serve?
Yes. In fact, I was part of the initial enlistment.
And why?
I want to serve because I believe deeply in public service. I want to give back to my country. In fact, I see my gay rights work as a form of public service. I think the American military specifically does a lot of good, not just here in America, but around the world. I have a family heritage. Both my grandfathers were in the Navy during World War II. One was a communications officer, one was a medical doctor, and I want to take part in that tradition.
Jake Raton is one of the organizers of the Soul Force Right to Serve campaign. For more, by the way, about the campaign, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Jake, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, time now for a couple of your thoughts on recent stories. This week, we spoke about problems with electronic voting machines. Dr. Robert Pastor, who heads American University's Center for Democracy and Election Management, said one big issue is electronic voting machines don't produce a backup paper trail. Well, Michael Toronto of Boston called with this comment.
I just don't get the complicated part of it. Maybe I'm too stupid. I go to my bank every day. I put my bank card in, I do my transaction, and I get a receipt. So the banks do it already. I mean, the truth of the matter is, if you really wanted, you could put a special code that the bank had. Once I entered my card in, it would register me through that code. I could do my voting on everything.
We also mentioned in that segment that the average age of poll workers is now 72, and they're less likely to know how to work with the new machines. Ellen Corbett of Greensboro, North Carolina, directed us to the woodshed. She writes, "Please stop talking about election workers as if they are doddering old wrecks. I'm the oldest worker in my precinct, and I'm 65. In our county, workers are trained before every election. Most of the problems seem to be the result of poor planning by the county officials, not the workers." Well, also this week, Harvard professor David Lapson told us about his research on shrouded or hidden costs and fees on everything from hotels to credit cards. Mary Scriver wrote, by the way, she lives in Valier, Montana, a little village of 300 folks near the Rocky Mountains among wheat fields, and she often calls herself Prairie Mary. She writes, "Shrouding, hidden costs, my foot. This is plain old-fashioned usury, and often the fine print hides the fact that one is guaranteeing the fees and interests with one's house. This is outrageous and wicked, a form of terrorism that often preys on low-income people." Well, we heard from many of you after our conversation with linguist Greg Pullum of the Online Language Log. Among the many things he said, the use of the word "like" is now okay by him. It's, like, acceptable. Some of you agreed, some disagreed, but also added, "How could you miss the musical connection?" Well, here it is, Loudon Wainwright's Cobwebs.
It's looking like a landmine, and almost ever since it's an assault to my mind's ear. Yeah, might have started back with Jack Kerouac. Probably more than likely it was made of G. Cribs. It's the four-letter word that used to mean as if, and the meaning's covered in cobwebs.
Like, as always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's like letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Please include your full name, phone number, and town. You're listening to Here and Now.
I heard it four times in one poor little sentence. It was the saddest sound I ever have heard.
Cleanliness is next to godliness. We've all heard that. And we know that all the major religions use water and ritual cleansing as a metaphor for spiritual cleanliness. Baptism for Christians, al-wudu or ritual ablution before prayer for Muslims. And then there's Shakespeare's Lady Macbeth.
What is it she does now? Look how she rubs her hands. it is an accustomed action with her to seem thus washing of her hands. I have known her continuing it a quarter of an hour. Mm. It is a spot.
How could she speak?
Out, damn spot! Out, I say!
Greta Saatchi as Lady Macbeth, trying to wash away the sin of murder, mirroring perhaps Pontius Pilate. Of course, neither could wash away their sins, but did they make themselves feel a little better? Well, Shenbo Zhang, a behavioral researcher at the University of Toronto's Rotman School of Management, asked that same question. He's here to tell us what he found. Professor Zhang, welcome.
Hey, Robin.
And we understand you set up experiments to find out if there was a connection between physical washing and moral purity. Let's start with telling us about one of those experiments. It involved a group of students and antiseptic wipes. What happened?
What we did in the experiment is we simply asked students to recall an unethical act that they had done in the past or an ethical behavior that they have done in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And then we approached the participants and told them that we had some materials left over from previous study that we wanted to give them away as a free gift. So participants were offered to choose between either an antiseptic wipe and a pen or a pencil as a free gift. What we found is that those who recalled an unethical behavior are much more likely to choose antiseptic wipe as a free gift compared to those who recalled ethical acts.
Because they want to cleanse themselves with it. Is that your thinking?
Yes.
Well, then in another experiment, you asked students to volunteer for a school project. What happened there?
In that study, we again asked all the participants to recall an unethical behavior that they have committed in the past. Now, following that, we provided half of the participants a chance to wash their hands, to cleanse their hands using antiseptic wipe, whereas the other half didn't get this chance.
Mm-hmm.
And then following that manipulation, we approached participants and told them that we had a graduate student in the department who is desperately trying to look for some volunteers in participating in her research. So the question here is, how likely are people volunteer to help out this person, depending on whether they had a chance to cleanse their hands or not?
And what'd you find?
What we found is that after recalling unethical behavior that they have done in the past, if they had a chance to cleanse their hands, they are much less likely to volunteer to help out another person, presumably because they had already overcome the moral burdens caused by the recall.
So the cleansing made them feel better about themselves, so they didn't need to perform some sort of project to make them feel good about themselves.
Indeed.
Huh. So the moral there would be, you know, try to get people who feel guilty about something who haven't yet washed if you have a project.
Yes. I mean, what you implied is absolutely correct. The sort of moral burdens, the guilt that we had left over from whatever mistakes that we have made past can motivate us to engage in altruistic behaviors such as helping out others or donate money. The question we should all ask ourselves is, are we happy that we let these feelings or burdens that, you know, can easily go away by simply engaging in washing hands?
Huh.
So is that the results that you really want?
Well, is that why people who do penance, and we hear the stories of the people who, you know, put a cross on their back, for instance, and allow themselves to get filthy, they don't bathe, and they travel the world and they beg for things, that they might actually be the ones who really are dealing with their feelings of guilt?
It's possible. I mean, people have different ways to deal with their moral burdens. Hand washing is one of those, and it turns out to be a very convenient one for them, and they don't realize the psychological impact of these mundane and seemingly innocuous daily practice. And I think it's important for us to be aware of these processes and actually take control of moral regulation.
Behavioral researcher Shenbo Zhang, he's speaking to us from his office at the University of Toronto's Rotman School of Management about his findings of the relationship between washing your hands and spiritual purity. Professor, thanks so much. Fascinating.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Six years ago, Esperanza Spalding had never even picked up an upright bass, but then few 15-year-old girls have. And how many women even play the bass? And how many bass players sing while they play? Esperanza Spalding is a rare bird. She stepped onto the bandstand as a teenager, has since toured the world, and now has a new trio and CD, Junjo. And we should add a title, Berklee Professor.
Yes.
Berklee currently. School of Music Professor. And look at you. How tall are you?
About 5'4". I like to give myself a couple extra inches sometimes.
Yeah, I'm going to say.
I'm actually only 5'4".
You are tiny.
Yeah.
So first, I just want to ask you about the physicality of playing the bass, mm-hmm. because you've even said in interviews, I mean, look how small your hands are.
Yeah, they're pretty small.
So was it when you first, you literally picked it up in the band room in high school?
Yeah, I just, you know, I was kind of bored in school. Mm-hmm. So I used to frolic around the halls freely. Mm-hmm. And one day when I wasn't being in a class I was supposed to be in, I walked into the band room and just started fiddling around. And it was fun on one level, but actually that same day I got this huge blister, you know, on my finger. And that should have, you know, warned me of what was in store, but I just couldn't stop.
Well, what was in store? Because, again, just staying with the physicality, you know, when you watch a bass player, they're almost, how would you describe it? Almost a dance with the bass.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, I don't know how many pounds of force that it requires to make a note, but it's definitely a lot, you know. Mm-hmm. And to just do that surely from, you know, your muscles against your spine, I guess, or from your feet, it'd be kind of hard on your body. So mm-hmm. you find ways to kind of use gravity up through your body and use the momentum of your arms moving and your hand moving. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it is kind of like a dance. You kind of flow around and move right. your body to the place it needs to be to get the note. And that's, especially for someone my size, I I have to do that. Otherwise, you know, probably in 5 years, I'd have arthritis everywhere, you know.
Well, that's the physical aspect. But you've been getting a lot of praise for the sound that comes out on this new CD. It's a classic sound, a piano trio. Two Cuban musicians are playing with you. Arawan Ortiz on piano, Francisco Mela on drums. And you pick up on that Afro-Cuban sound. Here's a song that you wrote with drummer Francisco Mela. This is Paracela. I'm wondering, too, Esperanza, how old are you now?
21.
Such a young age. You were homeschooled as a
yeah.
young girl on the West Coast?
Yeah.
Where's
yeah, in
that?
In Oregon.
In Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, left high school to go almost penniless to study here at Berklee School of Music in Boston. And then winter hit. And there you are trying to get your bass through the snowy streets of New England. No money. I mean, what kept you going?
You know, to be honest, I don't know. But I come from a family of, we're very adamant and very stubborn. And so when we put our mind to something, like, it's going to happen on yeah. some level or another. It's going to happen. And music was just, it made me happy. It was a thing to do. I had no concept of being a professional musician. Mm. Like, I couldn't even imagine that.
Much less a professor.
Oh, yeah. You know, so I came here and I just wanted to play and, you know, interact with people and just do my thing like I'd always been doing. And when it got to be that difficult, I was asking myself, why am I here, you know? Like, why did they ask me to come here? And, you know, it's the world works in mysterious ways because almost at the same time I ended up, you know, getting some work with Patty Austin. And that was like an incentive. Like, oh, okay, here's what this world has to offer, the world of being a professional musician. Through that, I saw these audiences. I said, okay, I see how it is. So all she does is sing. All she does is do music. And she's always creating it, and people come to see her. And that's how it works, you know? I really had no concept of this, you know? I mean, it sounds kind of silly, but, you know, and the more I was at Berklee, the more I started meeting these professional musicians. And, of course, at Berklee, like, everyone comes through at yeah. some point. You may not play with them, but you get to see them and you get to hear them. And so that inspired me.
Oh, I see how it works. She sings and people come to listen. And now you play and sing as well.
Yeah.
Did it ever occur to you that you couldn't do that? People say that's very hard.
It's it feels natural to me. I like to do it. When I'm practicing, I sing. It comes out. I used to learn tunes that way. I used to go over to my friend's house, Dan Gaynor. He was a wonderful piano player in Portland. And he'd teach me tunes. I couldn't really read charts, and we'd have all these gigs. And so the only way I could really learn the tunes, I'd go over to his house on the weekend, and we'd sit there for like 5 hours, and he'd just teach me all these tunes by ear. And it's much easier. I don't know if people realize this, but a lot of older musicians say this too. It's much easier to remember the tune if you know the lyrics, if you know the melody. So I'd learn the song, and I'd be singing it along with him, you know, playing the bass notes. Oh, this is the turnaround. Okay. And then he said, you know, you actually have a pretty good voice, like, for this. You should have a trio, and we can get, you know, paid as a quartet, go out and work, and it's just the three of us. And it was a great idea. We started, you know, it worked. It was beautiful. So we started doing that.
Well, then you also decided to sing in Spanish and Portuguese. Let's listen to one of the tunes on your new CD, Cantora
de Yala.
Okay.
Alegre como porras, donde el Santa se amanece. En manantial de sus coplas va, posan viejo viejo. En manantial de sus coplas va, despenando su soledad.
Esperanza Spalding, tell us about, you know, the walking bass line, you know, mm-hmm. that idea that you're like a praying mantis of music, you know, calling up. I just came up with that. But, you know,
That's pretty good.
But tell us about that, with that thing that's so specific to the bass.
Ooh. Walking is a really good way, it's a really good analogy. I was just thinking about this the other day. I was in Montreal with Joe Lovano, and I was walking around the city.
This is a terrific musician in his own right, and Berkeley
yes.
professor.
Oh, yeah. Phenomenal. And I was watching how people walk and their inconsistencies and their consistencies and how they sway, how they move. And the bass is kind of, it's the same function. It serves the same role in a band. It carries you around. It has this consistent pattern that mm-hmm. you depend on. You know your feet are going to fall into this way. And it's like, not to sound like a jerk, but it's like the band is like everything that you're walking through, everything that you're walking on. You know, mm-hmm. you need each other to have a significance, you know. And in the band, especially with drums, it's like working together, you propel the band forward. It's like a car and a motor, you know? And so it's just a trip. Like now I practice when I walk too, because I think about like, you know, having a more relaxed walk, but still being consistent and still having like a good forward motion. Or if I'm walking fast, like not getting too excited and like tensing up and just like being able to flow and walk fast. And it's the same motion. You think about what you're trying to get to, and you find the right means to get there, you know?
That is Esperanza Spalding and her new CD, Junjo. She's also a professor at Berklee School of Music and is touring with her trio and is 21 years old and is so much fun to listen to. Thanks so much for, I don't know, where you found the time coming to see us.
Thank you. No, it was a pleasure. It's a real pleasure. Thank you.
For more on her tour, visit our website, here-now.org. Quick thought earlier, we mentioned a linguist. He's Jeffrey Pullum. His website is The Language Log, and you can link to it at our website, here-now.org, and get information on everyone, including Esperanza. Here and Now, a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.